Spirit Radio Podcasts.
A court in Iran has ruled that the adopted daughter of a Christian couple who are both converts from Islam must be taken from them as they are not fit to be her parents. They adopted their daughter from an orphanage as a three-month-old baby in February 2019, and the judge has now ruled that she's considered a Muslim and as such by law ought only to be cared for by Muslim parents. On the line to tell us more, we have David Turner, who's the director of the Irish charity Church in Chains. David, good morning to you.
Good morning, Wendy.
Well, tell us a little bit more just about the backstory. What do we know about this Christian couple in Iran?
Yes, indeed. Well, the key phrase really is that they're both converts from Islam, and we've spoken many times before about the fact that so many Christians in Iran have come from a Muslim background, and the Iranian government is deeply concerned about this, and they are continually, through their Ministry of Intelligence, trying to break up house churches all over the country, trying to stop the spread of the scriptures in Iran. So Sam and Mariam are, as you said, both converts from Islam. And they've been married for about 13 years. They had no children of their own. And then, as you mentioned, in February of last year, they adopted a three-month-old baby who they've called Lydia. Now, Lydia, nobody knows her background. Nobody knows her parents. She suffers from quite a few illnesses, heart, gastrointestinal illnesses. But she's very happy with Sam and Mariam. And it's been interesting for us to just hear a little bit about what the judge has said in this case. The judge recognized that little Lydia, and I quote from his judgment, felt an intense emotional attachment to Sam and Mariam. And he said, considering the health of the child and her illness, there is zero possibility of giving her away to another family. And if she has to be handed back, it's possible that she would live in state institutions for the rest of her life. So it's a really sad, sad case coming to us from Iran.
It really seems, just as you kind of lay it out like that, David, because obviously often in these cases, it's the welfare of the child that matters most and that should be put first. But it seems that's not what is happening here.
Yes, indeed. We have heard from the group that broke this news called Article 18, which advocates for religious freedom in Iran. And their director, Mansour Bourji, who I know, he said, you know, you can just see through the words of the judge that the judge didn't want to make this ruling, but that his hands were tied by the Ministry of Intelligence. So we're really looking for a miracle in this case. We're encouraging people to pray for Sam and Mariam and Lydia, who is now coming up to 2 years old. The verdict has been issued. Many verdicts, it will go to an arm of the government to act on. And you know, I'd like to think that maybe the prayers of God's people in Ireland and around the world, and indeed, obviously, of Sam and Mariam, may yet mean that the verdict won't be acted upon and that somehow Lydia will be allowed to stay with them. I mean,
Who were the ones, David, or how did this end up in court in the first place?
Well, it ended up in court because the Ministry of Intelligence has been targeting Sam and Mariam and the house church to which they belong. So in July of last year, Sam and Mariam were arrested at their home for being involved in a house church. And the case came to court in April of this year, and they received sentences. So Sam has received a one-year jail sentence, which he has appealed, and Mariam has received a fine. But also, tellingly, and rather chillingly, she's been given a lifetime ban on working for any state institution in Iran, and that includes the hospital where she worked for over 20 years. So it's kind of vindictive targeting of Christians. Just
because of their conversion.
Exactly, exactly. So sadly, there is a high price to pay for leaving Islam and becoming a Christian in Iran. And because so many people are doing that, a recent academic study estimated that there's over a million Christians in Iran these days. And, you know, that's just exponential growth over the last 15, 20 years when the Islamic regime has been in power.
So, as you say, just in terms of what we can do at this point is pray is the primary thing, David, is it?
It is. It is indeed. Yes. I think prayer really is the main thing at this particular point. I'm not convinced that that advocacy at this particular point would be wise. There's a part of me that thinks that if this verdict and the paperwork surrounding it gathers dust on a shelf and other files are put on top of it, that would be a very good outcome. So we pray into that situation for that family, for Sam and Mariam and young Lydia.
So it would be nice now to move to some good news that the Church in Chains has received about prisoners in Pakistan being released. David, tell us about this.
Yes, indeed. Some of those listening to us might remember praying for Sawan Massey in Pakistan earlier this year. Every year we run our Lent prayer project, where we encourage Christians in Ireland to pray for one Christian prisoner somewhere around the world during the 6 weeks of Lent. And in the last week of Lent this year, we were praying for Sawan Massey. He's 40 years old, to remind listeners. He was a street sweeper from Lahore, and like so many Christian prisoners in Pakistan, he fell foul of the country's blasphemy law. He was accused of blasphemy by a Muslim friend back in 2013, and he's been in prison ever since. He's been on death row since 2014, and again, like so many of these cases in Pakistan that we've spoken about, his appeal against that sentence has just been adjourned repeatedly. So his case came once again to court just a little over a week ago, and we were just delighted to hear that instead of it being adjourned again, that the justice made a decision, and that decision was to acquit Sawan of blasphemy. The vast bulk of Christians who've been accused of blasphemy have never committed the offence that they've been accused of. But just because the word blasphemy is used, and because it strikes a note with extremists in Pakistan, judges just, in many ways, so frequently, just run away from issuing a verdict. But this time, a verdict was reached, and we rejoice in that.
So perhaps it will set a positive precedent then for other cases.
Yes, yes, indeed. Our immediate concern is for Sawan himself. We're in touch with our partners who are seeking to help him, and we just are very much hoping that the acquittal verdict that was announced by the judge will be respected in the prison. So in other words, that he will be released, the paperwork will come, and there'll be no obstacle put in the way of him being released from prison. And furthermore, we're hoping and praying that he and his wife, Sabaya, and they've three children, that they'll be able to live in safety in Pakistan. I suppose the most famous case of all has been the case of Asia Bibi, and you'll remember so much how when she was finally acquitted, that was not the end of the story, and she was held really virtually under house arrest for 6 months before she had to leave her country. But how wonderful it would be if, you know, this decision is respected, and if people say, well, you know, he wasn't guilty, just let him get on with his life, and then, you know, there would be the beginnings of hope that the dreadful injustices under these blasphemy laws will begin to be addressed one by one.
Indeed, indeed. Well, David, it's good to have some good news. And I believe as well there's other news from Eritrea after the release of 27 Christian prisoners in early September. Another group has been freed.
Yes, yes, indeed. It's always nice in the work of Church in Chains to be able to report on Christians being released from prison. And as you say, Eritrea is a country we've spoken about on many occasions before, with a dictatorial regime and with hundreds of Christians just put in prison just because the government doesn't like independent Christians in that country. It's closed so many of the churches. So all these prisoners were released from one prison called Mysarwa. They were released on bail, and the bail was secured basically by family and friends putting up the deeds of their homes. And the idea of this really is to try and make sure that these Christians who have just been released won't flee the country. They're mainly evangelical and Pentecostal. And, you know, we haven't publicised their names. We've been asked not to do that. But at least two of them are young women now who were children when they were put in prison. So there's one young woman who is now 28, who's been in this prison camp since she was 12 years old, and another who is now 30, who has been in prison since she's been 16 years old. So we just rejoice with the news of these releases. We were a little disappointed and was a little bit tempered to the fact that we heard news that five women had been arrested simply because they took to the streets to celebrate the releases. So there's a lot of work still to be done in Eritrea before all the prisoners are freed, but we do rejoice with those who rejoice and pray for God's blessing on them, and we will be working with our partner just to try and ensure that these released prisoners receive the supports that they need.
David, thank you so much for that update, and we will talk to you again soon. That's David Turner of the Church in Chains. Spirit. We often tell ourselves not to underestimate young people, and that is definitely true. But what about older people? Do we actually do the same for them? Well, my next guest is a longtime champion of the value of older people to society. He sees them and their immense potential and resourcefulness on a day-to-day basis as Professor in Medical Gerontology at Talla University Hospital and indeed Trinity College Dublin. He's also, among many other things, the founder-editor of the first Irish gerontology journal, Irish Ageing Studies Review. So we're going to be talking about some of his experience on the show today, and just particular our attitudes to older people in Ireland, and indeed how the COVID pandemic has impacted them. It's great to have with me on the line Professor Des O'Neill. Professor O'Neill, thanks for joining us on the programme today.
Thanks, delighted to be here. Thanks very much, and it's nice for you to give due prominence to what we have gained and what we potentially can further gain if we recognise the potential of older people.
And what do you think is our attitude overall to older people in Ireland?
Yeah, I think unfortunately there are some troubling signals here. The second Citizens' Assembly was on older people in Ireland, and instead of seeing this as a fantastic opportunity that we've all going to have a longer life, we're got the equivalent of an extra 5 hours a day if you evened it out compared to our grandparents. It was all about the potential burdens of healthcare and pensions. So it seems that we've bought into a kind of a failure dependency model rather than realizing actually we've much to learn and much to gain both personally and as a society from older people. And that covers a huge range. We think even in terms of Michael D. Higgins, our president, you know, this man in his 70s, fantastic in terms of the motivation, and Gabe Byrne continuing into late life to bring new insights into a whole range of areas in Irish life. Singers like Christy Moore, poets like Seamus Heaney and Thomas Kinsella. So that actually translates down to a lower level with all of us in terms of the fact that we now, many of us, can grow into adult life with our parents and generate richer and deeper relationships with them. Older people can now see grandchildren and great-grandchildren to an extent never seen before. And we can even learn much from how they're adapting and coping with the coronavirus epidemic. And what's slightly worrying sometimes, this is reported quite negatively, for example, that if older people use a helpline more, well, that's a good adaptive strategy.
Yeah, we automatically assume, you know, it's a negative. There was a report in the paper today just saying the increase in calls to senior line has increased by 200%, you know, with people getting in touch saying, just sharing how they're feeling during the pandemic. But automatically your gut is this is negative. But as you say, Professor O'Neill, is it a positive in that, well, these people are actually seeking help?
Yeah, and we need to learn. For example, a very large study in the UK looked at the first few months of the epidemic, and it showed that not only did older people seem to cope well, but they actually provided significant amount of help to others. We tend to, as I said, we've got to move away from this idea of older people as depending and requiring care and support. And so in fact, they're a positive attribute to their neighbours and to other people. Now, the hallmark of later life is increased differences between one person and another. So, of course, there will be people who have more disability as we get into later life. But that doesn't stop them being valuable, being loved, being important within their own families. And certainly my own mother's last 2 years in a nursing home, even with some dementia, was very valuable to me in terms of a growing and deepening relationship with her. So I suppose I struggle a little bit about why most of us understand that the older people in our family are valuable and people to be loved and actually give a depth and a richness to our life. And some strange things happen when we translate to that to the broader population. And I think we've got to kind of get over this.
What's the best way to do that? Is it about conversations? Is it about recognition?
Yeah, I think it's about conversations, about recognition. I think the other thing is what troubles me sometimes is the lack of knowledge and skills about aging within the government generally and public service, so that we even the use of the word elderly, for example, older people themselves have asked us not to use this. If this were LGBTQI or ethnic, we'd be really careful about
it. And you'd be listening to what these people are saying. And it's interesting you should say that, because obviously you think of your own family when we're talking about this. And my mum is in her kind of late 60s. And it amuses me in one way when I read in the paper an elderly woman of 65. And I don't see my mum in that way at all. And she certainly doesn't see herself that way.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think one of the things should be, around government and public service, we need more people who develop or take expertise in the science of aging, which is known as gerontology. And that's particularly the study of normal aging and the things that develop. And it's about understanding that we have what's known as an existential vulnerability. Of course, we're going to die and we're going to get conditions as we get older. The good news being, however, is that not only are we living longer, but we're living fitter and healthier. But also that having a disability, and again, it feeds a bit into our prejudice against disability, doesn't stop you from being valuable in your own right or contributing. And one of the examples I often use is the great French artist Matisse, who for the last 7 years of his life was bedbound and chairbound. So you talk about an 83-year-old who's bedbound and chairbound, and immediately people are thinking down the downward slope. And yet he produced some of his most fantastic, exciting, vibrant and radical works at this time. So it's around us developing a narrative and a discourse that uses these stories, that doesn't downplay. Of course, we've got to support disability. Of course, we've got to support the changes in life. But interestingly, one of the factors from theories of aging is the nearer we are to understanding that we might die or having disabilities, the more we search for meaning. And actually, the more we become our authentic selves. So late life is an opportunity to become your most authentic and valuable self. And this is an opportunity that's been gifted to us in over the last 20 to 40 years.
It's interesting, Professor Neil, just some of the examples that you give, where is a lot of the issue that we as a society, we often tend to make subjective value judgments based on, what's on paper, what we think a person's contribution or quality of life might be. And the reality is so different.
Yeah, no. This is a very well established that we're very gulled perhaps by the physical attributes of a disability or our popular images, and that if the person with that disability or dementia or whatever rates their quality of life at 10, those around them will rate it at 8 out of 10 or 7 out of 10. So we tend to not see what the real value and how people are managing and coping. And study after study from around the world, from our Irish longitudinal database, others show that despite the downsides of later life, most people report greater life satisfaction, greater ability to cope with the challenges that are put up to them. So, you know, it is a complex idea that you can grow in later life, whereas we've been so used to the idea of loss in later life. So if we can get that message across, you both grow and lose at all stages of life, and later life is no different.
Is there ways, Professor O'Neill, that we even unconsciously show prejudice towards older people and discriminate against them without knowing it?
Yeah, I think probably the biggest way is around oversimplifying. So I think, for example, the whole thing about over 70s and cocooning and the tone of the advice there. Now, at the very earliest stages when we saw Italy and everything else, you know, I would have said, look, this is an emergency measure till we know where we're going better. But I think increasingly all of us in this sphere have said, you know, we've got to start rethinking this. This is a very heterogeneous, very mixed group of people. And indeed, there are people younger who've got vulnerabilities, and it should be around both vulnerabilities. But I think the real problem with the whole cocooning lockdown was we didn't make a partnership with older people and say, look, here's the risks, here how you manage with them. And my advice to all older people is not to view what you're hearing about COVID-19, not to think of it in terms of restrictions, but think of it in terms of the things you can do. So if you can exercise within 5 kilometres of your house, go 4.9 kilometres. You know, go out and about and do your business. Just, you know, we'll treat you like responsible adults. And indeed, they are a very responsible group of people and a very giving group of people, very supportive of neighbours and others.
What's the best way then, especially at this time, Professor O'Neill, for those who are listening to you and they are really convicted by what you're saying, is how do we best give space for older people to continue to contribute and thrive in our society, bearing that we're in the middle of a pandemic as well?
Yeah, I think it's by looking at the most important thing is to look at the evidence, and also to perhaps to see can we change our mindset from one of older people as dependent to older people as a positive attribute in our society. And the evidence is actually quite reassuring. And actually, in my own group, I have to say I tend to, in my mind, give out to gerontologists who do studies of things like loneliness and stress in older people without comparing it to other age groups. So we in gerontology have to get our house in order, and we have to start looking at all of these issues across the lifespan, and not just a study of loneliness in older people or a study of mental health in older people, but across the lifespan and what can each group contribute to the other.
Spirit. Our next guest is chairperson of an Irish charity that supports economically deprived communities in Belarus, with our next guest having travelled to Belarus almost 50 times in the last 16 years. He has seen firsthand the need for on the ground and the needs that they have in these communities. On the line to tell us more about one of their campaigns, which is the Babushka Box Appeal, we have Brian Kelly, chairperson of the charity Pashley. Brian, good morning to you.
Good morning, Wendy. How are you?
So tell us a little bit about Pashley and your involvement with it.
Yeah, thanks, Wendy. First of all, thanks for having us on. Yeah, Pashley it's a Russian word and it means let's go in Russian. And we've been working out in Belarus since 2004. We went out, we had a team out there. We started off with small construction teams going out and working in a couple of orphanages, and then we were working in an old people's home. And since 2004, we've had at least one, if not two or three teams out there every year since. And then we started bringing children in here. They were staying with host families in the summertime and at Christmas. And also then we have the Babushka Box Appeal, which is shoeboxes for old people, for grannies and granddads. Babushka, I don't know if you remember, there used to be a song years ago called Babushka. But Babushka is grandmother in Russian, and Dadushka is grandfather in Russian. So we do boxes for the old people.
Because, of course, Brian, people are familiar with kind of shoebox appeals for children.
Yeah.
And is it that older people are sometimes forgotten?
Hugely so. And like, Belarus has been through, like, multiple wars. I mean, a lot of the people that we would meet and sit with and talk with would have been kids in the Second World War, would have lived in the poverty that was left after the Second World War. You'd have kids talking about wrapping grass, or people, sorry, old ladies telling us about when they were children, wrapping grass around their feet for shoes, and eating grass, and living in the forest, and living in real poverty, and then growing up with a hard life, living under the communist regime of Stalin, and family members going missing.
It's incredible to think what some of these older people have been through.
Oh, they've been through what we read in history books. Now, I'm 61, okay? And when I'm talking old people, I'm talking about people in their 80s and 90s, and they have just had horrible lives, really horrible lives. Hard lives. And then they get to the end of their working life and they're kind of like discarded because they're of no value to the state anymore. And that would have been the communist system. And it's not an awful lot better at the minute. There's a lot of political unrest over there at the moment. And there's still a huge amount of poverty in the country. And old people are kind of like way down in the pecking order.
So what is life like for an older person in Belarus at the moment?
It depends on if you live in a city or a village. And both would suffer hugely with loneliness and being left, similar to old people here too. I know we have lots of people saying that happens here too, and it does. But they would live under a system that is quite oppressive. They would be valued very little by the system. They would have very little social services like we have. There are some. We have found one lady, Ludmilla is her name, who runs a social service area in the area where we work mainly, and she has been fantastic with old people. But many of the other areas would have no social services for them at all. There wouldn't be social clubs, or there wouldn't be backup. Right at this minute in time, there isn't even any support for them around the whole COVID thing or anything like that at all. They would live, a lot of them would live in a lot of poverty. You'd have winter temperatures over there going down to minus 20, minus 25. So you've got people living in villages who would be living on their own, wouldn't be able to afford firewood, that kind of stuff. So there's a lot of poverty and a lot of distress, I suppose, as well.
So tell us a little bit about the Babushka Box campaign then. What's it all about, Brian?
Okay, so what we do is we connect with this lady, Ludmilla, and we send her over as many shoeboxes as we can get. We have managed over the last number of years to raise 1,250 shoeboxes a year, which isn't an awful lot. She, in her area alone, could take 33,000 shoeboxes. So we've plenty of room for expansion, hence the talking to people and trying to grow it. The year we pick in a pandemic, I know, but we're trying to grow this. So the shoebox is basically very similar to the idea of what we used to do for the kids, and our kids did that too. And we get a shoebox, wrap it in Christmas paper, only we put stuff in it that you would buy for your granny. Thermal underwear, thermal socks, hats, gloves, scarves. They're not so big on toothpaste and toothbrushes because most of them don't have any teeth left, to be honest with you. Maybe some jellies, some pearls or things like that, some costume jewellery for some of the ladies, a pack of dominoes or a deck of cards for the men, simple stuff, Sudoku books, things like that. That really, really... And what happens is we've had the privilege of getting Wendy to sit and hand these boxes out.
And you've been there, Ryan. Have you been there when the Babushka boxes have been given out?
Oh, God, yeah. Oh, just ripped the heart out of you in the most amazing way.
So what's it been like?
It's just phenomenal to see somebody, and when you go back the next year, the shoebox is still sitting on their little locker beside their bed, which is the only piece of space that they own in this Norsen home, and the shoebox and a picture of maybe the family that sent it over to them stuck up on the wall as if it's their family. The shoebox is still pristine. Sometimes they still have the stuff folded up and put back into the shoebox after they use it. It's just amazing, and the joy that you see in their faces when you give it to them, giving them a hug. I know we're not allowed hugging on that now, but in the normal circumstances, just being able to show them a bit of love and hand them a present. What they can't get over is that somebody who doesn't even live in their country would bother to go and put this together and bring it over for them. It's just amazing.
And the impact that has. So, Brian, how can people get involved? How can listeners support the Babushka Box appeal?
Well, they can make a shoebox, and we will organise. If they want to go onto our website, it's pashli.org, pashli.org, and we have information on there. We have leaflets that we can post out to people, which give all the information about how to make a shoebox and what to put in it and what not to put in it. We have different collection points around the country, and we have to be very careful, obviously, because of the pandemic this year, but we're going to walk around the guidelines and walk within the guidelines, not around them, sorry, and make sure that everybody working on the shoeboxes are safe. We're planning on sending a truck out in the beginning of December with the shoeboxes. So if people would like to make a shoebox, if they can't make a shoebox and they'd like to make a donation towards us getting some stuff to put into other shoeboxes, they can do that on the website as well. And they could just tell their friends about it. Check us out on Facebook. find out and share the news, because if they can't, maybe someone they know can.
Exactly. And do you think you'll be able to get the shoeboxes over to Belarus this year?
Yes, please God, yeah. Things are looking, it's tight, because like I said, there is a lot of political rest over there, unrest at the moment, because there was presidential elections in August, and the man who's in power over there, Lukashenko, has been there for the last 26 years, since 1994, and most of the people who are in opposition are either in jail. There's protests going on. Actually, there was a pensioners protest on Monday. Some awful stuff you see, and the police pepper spraying pensioners and beating them with batons and stuff like that. It's just really sad to see, and these people were just walking down the street peacefully protesting. So, like, I mean, I was listening to that gentleman you had on just before me talking about the elderly people here, but we don't have to live in that kind of an oppression. We don't have to live with that kind of fear and that kind of stuff going on in this country. We're really blessed, but these folks need somebody just to reach out and show them a bit of love and that someone cares about them.
Indeed, and Brian, listen, thanks so much for joining us on the programme today and for all the hard work that you're doing. That's Brian Kelly, the chairperson of the charity called Pashley. And if you want to find out more about their work or indeed support the Babushka Box appeal, you can go to their website, which is Pashley, that's Pashli.org.
Thanks for listening to our Spirit Radio podcast. Don't miss out. Subscribe today. Find out how at spiritradio.ie. Yeah.